Hey, Media People podcast listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, then you're going to love our newsletter, appropriately named the Media People Newsletter. Delivered right to your inbox, each edition is a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or go to mediapeople.behive.com. That's B-E-E-H-I-I-V. Thanks for listening to the Media People Podcast, lively and insightful chats with the people who power the media industry. I'm your host, Victor Genova. For more episodes, you can go to mediapeople.ca or subscribe wherever you get podcasts, including youtube.com/@mediapeoplepodcast. Views expressed by participants are personal. Sales is a performative art, and presentations are like a play. Notes serve as the script, while the PowerPoint deck acts as the set. The boardroom, the stage, and clients, the audience. At the heart of the production, the sales rep. When comparing the two professions, you can see why today's guest, Christy Painting, has enjoyed a successful sales career. Christy is Pinterest's country manager for Canada, and while many people in her position have a marketing or business degree, Christy majored in drama. Her first job out of university was handling pharmaceutical orders. Christy wasn't enthused by the work and quickly moved into local print media sales. She shifted into roles with Yahoo and DoubleClick and ascended into leadership positions at Olive Media and Bell Media, to name a few. Christy Painting stops by to chat about growing up in suburban Toronto, her passion for the dramatic arts, her media sales career, why she took an agency job, and leading Pinterest's Canadian office.
Pinterest is a visual search engine that really lives at the intersection of search, social, and commerce. Our users come for inspiration on a wide variety of topics, from beauty and fashion to home renos to food and recipes, art and design, even travel. And users explore Pinterest for big moments like weddings, small moments like dinner time, to move from discovery to decision to do, to actual execution. And that gives advertisers an incredible opportunity to sort of add value to this decision journey by meeting them where they are with what they need.
Christy, thank you so much for stopping by. We have been trying to get this on the books for a while. We're recording this in March. It goes live in April. But little does everyone know that we have been talking as far back as September of 2023. So thank you so much for carving out a bit of time in your busy schedule for us. As always, though, we go back to the beginning. You're from Toronto. Suburban Toronto or Toronto proper?
I'm from the suburbs. I'm from the West End, although I'm actually the daughter of a Brit and a Canadian. They literally met at the airport where they were both working for British Airways. And after they met and married, they sort of had this incredibly glamorous life where they lived in all different kinds of countries. They went to England. They spent some time in the Middle East, in Iran. My sister was born in Kuwait. They lived in the Caribbean for a little while. And it was only after we had actually lived in Antigua for about almost 4 years, and both my sister and I were sort of approaching school age, that my mother said, you know, enough is enough. It's time for the girls to go back to school, and we're moving back to Canada. And so we came back to Toronto and settled in the West End, where my mom was from, and sort of established ourselves there. And that's more or less where I grew up.
So you had a pretty nomadic childhood, it sounds like.
Well, it's interesting. Certainly when we were quite young, and then we were relatively stable for a while. For a couple of years in middle school for me and high school for my sister, we moved to the US. I lived in California for a little while. I was literally living in the Valley during the Valley Girl era. I had a great Valley Girl voice and accent that I can still probably do from time to time after a glass of wine. And then we were there for about 18 months or so, and then moved to the opposite coast and lived in Connecticut, which was very much, you know, lace collars and pearls, right in key kind of Martha Stewart era, and lived there for just a little while before pleading with our parents to come back to Canada and returning to Toronto. And again, more or less where we had started.
Was there any sort of culture shock going in between all those places like Connecticut or California and then coming back to Toronto?
Oh, it was very intense. I mean, we lived in California while Reagan was president. It was very much Cold War era the high school that I attended, the middle school that I attended, literally had a bomb shelter in the basement, designed for like as a fallout shelter with enough freeze-dried food to keep all the students for about 3 months. It was completely different from what I had come from, and quite different from what I had returned to. You know, it was almost like a fever dream when I think back on it now.
I was a child of the Cold War, I guess you could say, too. We didn't have that in my school. For reference, I grew up in Mississauga, but we did have one school in the neighborhood that had a giant air raid siren on top of it. It looked like a giant jet engine. And I remember, I want to say I was like 6 or 7, it accidentally had gone off. And it really spooked people in the neighborhood because you're living in suburban Toronto. You don't think anything's really going to happen. The Cold War, this is the 80s. The Cold War had been going on for about 20 plus years or so. And all of a sudden that goes off. I slept through it because I'll sleep through anything. But I remember it did spook some people in the neighborhood because it'd gone off for like maybe about 20 seconds or so. And they thought, oh my God, what should we do? And so that's the way the mentality was when you were, or at least the culture was when you were living in California, that even though everything was very rosy and very comfortable, things could go sideways at any moment and you had to be prepared for it.
It was a different level of emergency preparedness. I mean, the Cold War was really not something I had spent a lot of time really thinking about. And then, of course, the other thing you had to worry about was earthquakes. And so we would do, whereas we had done fire drills when I lived in Toronto, we did earthquake drills where you had to get under your desk and cover your head, or you had to find a doorway and kind of brace yourself in it, which was a completely different way of reacting to emergencies than I was accustomed to. Fortunately, there were never any big ones while I was there, a few little tremors, but nothing too drastic.
You were big into drama as a child, or I should say drama club. When I say it that way, it makes it seem like drama in general, but drama club, what attracted you to just the dramatic arts in general?
I love theater. I still go to the theater regularly. I think there's something very appealing about being able to put on a persona, to know exactly what words you're going to say, but to feel them and live them and animate them in that moment so that they feel real and fresh and spontaneous. And that sort of craft of being able to understand exactly what needed to play out, but be able to imbue it with an animation and a spontaneity in that moment, sort of to create that chemistry with your fellow actors, was, I thought, really, really magical. I really loved it. It was also just, I wasn't very good at sports, particularly team sports. So it was a really nice way for me to meet people and have a social circle of, you know, like-minded kids who, you know, like to nerd out like I did in the dramatic arts.
When we say plays and theater, do you also include musicals into that?
I wish I could include musicals in that. I have like sort of a very ordinary singing voice, nothing at all strong enough to hold a musical tune. So that was never my milieu, I'll say. I really enjoyed Shakespeare, and I did a lot of theater in high school, but then I went on to university and we did like a lot of Elizabethan theater there. And that was, again, that's like an additional challenge of trying to make these words, which are not instantly comprehensible to a contemporary audience, but trying to make them really meaningful and ensure that the meaning is communicated, even if the words themselves create a bit of friction with the audience. So really, really kind of bridging that gap for the viewers, it was a special kind of challenge, and one that I always really enjoyed.
Do you have a favorite play?
Midsummer Night's Dream is my favorite. I was so lucky. I was able to perform that when I was at McMaster, where there's this beautiful outdoor natural amphitheater outside called Faculty Hollow. And there was this gorgeous green hill with a little culvert at the bottom that was all surrounded by beautiful trees. And the audience sat on the hill, and we erected a stage at the base. And I got to play Puck, this sort of wood nymph that created mischief throughout the play and was a catalyst for all the action that happened, and sort of flitted around the edges almost as a narrator. And that was my favorite role and still one of my favorite plays.
It sounds like it was Shakespeare in the Park.
That was the idea on a smaller scale, for sure.
Who were your influences growing up? Like, who did you look up to?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I wasn't really into sports per se. I was a figure skater, and so I did spend a lot of time watching figure skating and ice dancing. So I was really interested in what Torvald and Dean were doing in the field of ice dancing, and as well as skaters like Katarina Witt, who was, you know, really changing the complexion of ice skating at that time. So that was, it was kind of a very exciting time, I think, for from an athletic perspective. But yeah, I think beyond that, I really admired my parents. They were both very hardworking, but managed to really balance the family, our family, with everything that they were doing career wise. And I think back on how they managed that and made it look pretty easy, when I know from experience it's really not. So I have always really appreciated the stability that they gave me as a child.
You mentioned you were a figure skater. Do you think you were attracted to the performative aspect of it, similar to how you were also very big into theater?
Great question. I haven't really thought about it all that much. I think it was just something that I learned to do. My mother was an ice dancer, and so she introduced me to it. And it was something that I was able to do, where most sort of athletic endeavors eluded me. I didn't really like team sports. I found them really challenging, but skating was something that I could achieve. So I felt pretty relaxed. But you know, you're right, there was a component of costume and bringing sort of personality and animating the story. So perhaps you're onto something. Maybe there's something that I shine in front of an audience. That's what I need to bring me alive.
Every presentation you deliver is a performance. That's what I'm always saying to people when I'm coaching them on presentations. You've got to treat it like a performance. You've got to watch them and make sure they're engaged.
That's very true.
I think we can understand why you picked drama and history to study in university. You've already mentioned that, but why did you choose McMaster University?
I was young when I went to university. I was only 17. I know that's de rigueur now, but at the time it was unusual. And so I knew I wanted to go away from home. I knew I wanted an experience of autonomy, but I didn't want to go all that far away. And so I was looking really relatively sort of within the Golden Horseshoe or thereabouts. But what really did the trick for me is I had gone to McMaster, and I was doing a tour, and I had this wonderful tour guide who really knew the school, and he wrote for the newspaper. And so he was this sort of really compelling, I'm sure his tour was a performance of his own. And we got to the drama section, and he said, this has been a very exciting year. We've had a writer in residence this year. And I said, well, who is it? And he said, well, Tom Stoppard has been at McMaster, and he's been our writer in residence. And Tom Stoppard, it was, you know, the greatest living absurdist playwright. I loved his work. I really admired the plays that he produced. And I sort of gasped and thought, oh my gosh, you know, if Tom Stoppard is here this year, who will be the writer in residence next year? You know, this must be a really incredible program to be able to attract that caliber of talent. So that really switched me on, and I really wasn't able to consider any other options because that loomed so large in my imagination. Now, truthfully, McMaster had one writer in residence over their entirety, and that was Tom Stoppard that one year. They never had one before. They never had one afterwards. I certainly never benefited from it, but it was a really vibrant drama faculty at the time. There were great profs. There were a lot of really engaged students. And I have to say that I made all of my best friends during those years. And I really treasure them. They changed the trajectory of my life for sure. And I think really created the reality I have today.
I always ask my guests what their first job ever was. And it's usually something along the lines of babysitting, or maybe they had a paper route. Some people worked in quick service restaurants, QSRs. You had a very specific one that a lot of the Canadian people listening to this, specifically from Toronto, are going to jump at. Tell everyone what was so special about the C&E food building.
Oh, I did. I worked at the food building. I worked for Maple Leaf Foods, which was distinguished by having the absolute cheapest meal that you could buy in the food building. I think hot dogs were 50 cents. And, you know, a back bacon sandwich was $2 or something. That was the highest priced item that we sold. And so we always had an enormous line stretching around the corner. And we were located right beside the Tiny Tim Donuts, which, again, if anyone's ever been to the X, you know it. I know you know it.
Oh,
so
I know it.
That combination was just this enormous. It was so high pressure. It was nonstop. We had 6 hour shifts, 6 days a week for the duration of the X, and it was, you know, it was a great experience. It was lots of fun. There were, you know, lots of kids my own age working there. Almost all of us had family members who worked for Maple Leaf who had sort of got this job lined up for us. But it was, yeah, it was a moment in time.
Can we say that the food building is like a food court on steroids, and then it takes another dose of steroids after that? Like, I don't even think that line, "it's the food court on steroids," does it justice. You kind of have to find a way to exaggerate it further.
It was intense. Like, the smells and the sound, and I don't think I could do it today. There's no way I could do it today. I think the sensory overload would probably overwhelm me. But at the time, it was just kind of what you did, you know, it was normal. So that's what we did. But it was a moment for sure.
What did you learn about yourself working in the food business?
I learned that I actually really love to talk to people and serving people and making them happy. Like, food service is really interesting because it is the easiest way to make somebody happy. When they're hungry and you put food in front of them, they're immediately happy, unless there's something drastically wrong. And if there is, you know, changing that is actually not that difficult. So really understanding how do you become as efficient as possible. All they want to do is, you know, get through this motion as fast as they can and get something that they want at the end of it. So being able to do that, you know, pleasantly and with a smile and as quickly as possible is sort of key to that experience. And I would actually argue it's sort of key to any service, that if you're able to deliver, you know, good professional service with a smile and get people what they want as fast as you can. That's an outcome we should all be striving for.
Your first job after university was not in media and marketing. You were a pharmaceutical order taker. Explain that one to us, even though it does seem very self-explanatory.
Oh, it was a terrible job. I worked for, and it was just awful. I did it for about 3 months, and I worked in an unheated warehouse that was so cold that we were issued heating pads to keep our hands warm so that we could type into, like, do the order taking into the keyboard. And I had been hired actually to be a bilingual order taker, which was funny because I spoke a little French, but certainly not fluently. But there were so few Francophones, I guess, in Hamilton at that time that they kind of took what they could get, which at that moment was me. And so I would sit on the phone all day and talk to pharmacists who would read out columns of numbers, order numbers to me of various drugs, which I would then just sort of key in and try to do it as quickly as possible and as accurately as possible. But it was very transactional. There was very little pleasure to be derived from the experience, or, you know, relationships to build, or even really value to drive. It was a very tough job, and I did it for about 3 months. Nobody really did it much longer than 3 months. There was a constant turnover, and for me, it came when some kind of an event that the pharmacists were all invited to. And a friend of mine who I'd gone to high school with showed up, and he'd graduated from university and he'd gone on and he'd studied pharmacy. And now he was starting this career as a pharmacist. And I thought, oh my God, what am I doing? Here I am punching in orders in a language I don't even really speak. While, you know, my friend Gary has actually started his career and is doing something and going somewhere. And I sort of said, Christy, this is no bueno. We need to think about what the next step is and point ourselves in the right direction here and decide what you'd like to do when you grow up, because it's coming fast and it's time to embrace it. So that was kind of my jolt of awareness that it was time to get focused and decide what my next step really needed to be.
We're going to take a quick break. Enjoying this episode? Of course you are, or you wouldn't have made it this far. Compliment your listening experience by subscribing to the Media People newsletter at mediapeople.ca/newsletter
or at mediapeople.beehive.com. It's a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or mediapeople.beehive.com.
Let's talk about your move into media and marketing. You landed at Now Magazine. So that is a massive pivot. You're a theater graduate, a drama student. You move into, like you said, the warehouse doing pharmaceutical orders, and now you're in media sales. So how did that come about?
Well, there was actually one more step. So my dad was in marketing, and you know, after that, I had this epiphany about maybe it's time to do something with my life. I telephoned him and I said, how do I do what you do, Dad? How does that work? And he said, well, I subscribe to Marketing Magazine. I'll tell you what, I'll mail you the back issues once I'm done with them, and you can go through the classified ads. This is pre-internet, obviously, and this was the most efficient system we came up with. And so I answered a classified ad at the back of Marketing Magazine for a small rep shop that was called Magazine Network. And then I went along and did the interview, and miraculously I landed the job, because I think it was quite competitive at the time. And I was really just working as a sales coordinator, as a receptionist, which I had quite a bit of experience doing. That was kind of how I paid the bills while I was going to university. And we were representing a number of different things. We represented magazines, we represented community newspapers, and we also represented a network of urban weeklies, like Now Magazine, but in markets outside of Toronto, and including, you know, Vancouver and Edmonton and Calgary and Halifax and Montreal. So I was working there really in a support function. And after about 6 months or so, they said, you know, are you interested in taking on a bit of a territory? And I said, of course, show me how. And so I began working with them and learned the ways of the Urban Weekly. And then, you know, looked sort of around the corner and realized that there was a big Urban Weekly operating in my city, and that I now had enough experience that I might be able to get in there on the ground floor, and applied for a sales role and landed it, which was, you know, thrilling for me. It was in the peak of Urban Weeklies. There was a time when Urban Weeklies were absolutely soaring, and you know, culturally they were extremely vibrant. There was a big music scene in Toronto. There was a big comedy scene. There was a huge food scene. I mean, there still is a lot of those things, but it was all centered around these magazines before the internet that were the sort of the arbiters of cultural taste in a way. So it was a really exciting time to work there. It was a very tough sales job. It was open territory, straight commission. And I think I mentioned pre-internet. So I used to literally, I would park my car and I would walk down one side of a street and basically knock on every business's door, every restaurant, every boutique. I'd go in and sort of ask them what their marketing strategy was. And then I'd get to the end of the block and I'd cross the street and I'd walk back, pick up my car, drive another couple of blocks and do the whole thing again. And that's kind of how I would spend my weeks, just prospecting nonstop. Sometimes I'd get out the yellow pages and do it by the phone, but I found I was most effective when I was in person. And so I did that for, oh gosh, about 4 years or so, just building up my book of business and seeing what restaurants were opening and what new businesses were starting, and really talking to the owners about their marketing strategies and how they were going to be discovered by Toronto, which was a hugely competitive market. So, you know, they would literally open the cash register and hand me the payment for the ad, and I'd have to like take it home, tuck it inside my jacket, and then take it home and take it up to accounting and make sure that they got it. It was that real, and I felt a huge amount of responsibility to make that advertising work for those merchants, because it was literally coming out of their pocket to fund their business and stimulate growth for their business, which was their dream. It was this incredible experience to be so connected, something you don't get as much with bigger advertisers or agencies.
Did you enjoy the hunt? Because you mentioned it was an open territory that you were literally prospecting by going door to door. Did you enjoy that part of it?
It was probably the best training I ever could have had, because you could tell right away as you were talking to people what they were responding to and what they weren't. And so you were constantly pivoting your approach to make sure you were aligning with their objectives. And I became quite good at doing the discovery upfront to really understand what their motivation was and what was driving them and where they thought success was going to come from. And once I understood that, then I could really say, okay, this is how we can match, you know, this to what you're trying to achieve. And this is the approach that I would recommend. So it was extremely gratifying when I was successful with that. And yeah, it was an absolute thrill to be able to close these businesses that, that, you know, needed the advice, but, you know, also know that we had to perform, because there would be no tolerance for something that wasn't performant for them.
Do you think your theater experience went a long way in helping you in that job? Because if you can perform in front of 300 strangers, that must make it easier for you to walk up to one stranger and go, "Hey, I'm so-and-so, let's talk about your marketing budgets," or whatever your talking points were when you were making that cold approach.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that we all do, whether we're sellers or business people or anything that we do, is being able to focus ourselves and being able to energize ourselves to be really concentrated and focused and present in that moment to connect with the people, the person that you're speaking to, whether it's one-on-one or whether it's one-to-many. Just try to create the energy and try to create the connection point to build that chemistry that people respond to. I think that's exactly right. I think it served me very well. It certainly gave me the confidence to be able to walk in to these strangers' businesses and ask them for their money, which is, you know, perhaps one of the hardest things to ask for.
That's what we do. I'm also in sales, and when people ask me what I do, I just get to the point. I go, I chase people for money. I mean, there's a lot more to it, but that's what we do.
Yeah, and I think part of it was learning how to also understand the business solution, because you could close someone for money once, but you couldn't then go back. If it didn't work, you couldn't return. And I quickly learned it was much more efficient to be able to talk to somebody and help to build a business strategy that you both felt connected to, you both felt bought into, and really make sure that was working and performing for them. That was the beginning of a relationship that was sustainable, and that created this base of my book of business that I could then grow on. Whereas I watched many of my colleagues who came at the same time as me, you know, just churn and burn within 3 or 6 months, because they couldn't, they could close some of the business up front, but they couldn't sustain it. And so creating those relationships and being trustworthy, being credible, ensuring that, you know, you were committed to the merchant's success was really key to being able to sustain that relationship and deliver value, which I think it's a key part of any business relationship.
Your time at DoubleClick, was this before it was acquired by Google?
It was publicly traded. It was a tech company. It was an ad server, but they had also developed a media business. And so I was working on the media business side. They had networked a bunch of sites. This was sort of pre-search engine. I actually joined them just after the bottom had fallen out of the dot-com market. So I was there for just about a year. So the bottom fell out of the dot-com market. I joined, the towers came down about a year later, and they shut the whole media operation down. And that was it for me. That was my short stint at DoubleClick. But it did get me into the digital world, which I knew I wanted to do. And so it was a great experience, you know, even though it was short and a bit ill-conceived for me timing wise, it was the beginning of really that shift to digital sales.
And your next role, that was at Yahoo, if I've got this correct, and you were a strategic account executive there.
That's right. So I left DoubleClick, and I went to Yahoo, which was just sort of taking off as this portal I started working with the very few digital buyers who were operating at the agencies. There were not very many of us. It was a very tight community. I got to know many of those sort of single digital buyers in their departments. I'm still very good friends with many of them today, who now hold, you know, extremely senior positions within our digital ecosystem. But we did some really fun stuff. I remember selling the very first out of the box. It was a digital overlay campaign where the masthead, a car drove onto the masthead and then sort of came apart and then came back together again. And this was groundbreaking stuff at the time. It was very exciting. I think the Media Planner won an award for it. So we were doing some really exciting skins and different colors and really stretching the boundaries of what was possible in the digital landscape. It was a really fun and dynamic time to be in digital.
Your jump to Olive Media, you move out of, I guess, a sales first role, and you are the general manager, VP, sales and marketing. So it looks like you're wearing about two or three hats there. Talk to us about the transition into that kind of a level of a leadership role, because you were having a great time as a player and now you have to be a coach. Was that a bit of a struggle for you, like getting out of the trenches and going, okay, I can't do this anymore. I've got other people that do that. I've got other things that I have to concern myself with.
It was an interesting time. I actually thought that I wanted to make a shift into operations. I wanted to ensure that things were sort of really running smoothly. And so when I joined Olive Media, It was in its very, very early days. It really didn't exist as Olive. I joined, we named it, we threw a party, and we started to acquire sites sort of in the first 6 to 8 weeks was kind of the trajectory there. And very quickly, I realized operations was not a place that was very suitable for me, and that I was much better suited for sales. And I had a couple of salespeople, but my next role was just to staff up and find the right people that were going to be really committed to this company and wanted to make it super successful. And so that's what we did. It was about, we were building the business. It was, Olive Media was a joint venture between two newspaper companies, Torstar Digital and Jessica Digital, La Presse. So we were working with these two big Canadian newspapers who knew that digital was here. They knew it was going to be an important part of their business, but they didn't really know how to build the capability for that. And so we were brought in as a team of digital experts to network these two newspapers together, and very quickly said, you know, we could make this bigger yet if we started to sell Canadian ads on US websites. So, you know, why don't we try to find the biggest US websites in all of the most important categories for advertisers, bring it to Canada and make it really easy for all these digital buyers to execute their buys, you know, across these websites that they want to access. But when they phone the sites in the US, nobody even really wants to take their calls because the dollars that they're spending aren't significant in the context of US spend. So that was the idea behind Olive. And you know, we built up that business really quickly, and really successfully along this model. It was so successful that many other Canadian publishers began to look at the model and stand up their own versions of it, which compressed our margins somewhat, made it a little bit more difficult to be successful. But I think that the hardest thing about Olive was that it wasn't a defendable model. It was something that others could do. So we really focused then on having the best sites, having the best service, having the best sales team. And that was my focus during the time that I was there. I started as a director of sales, became a VP, and then only after the president left did I move into more of a GM role.
And you started this by talking about throwing a party, because that's something Olive was known for. I had never been to any of the legendary parties, but I know Olive Media isn't around anymore. But if I'm talking to any of my colleagues that happen to work at Olive or worked closely with people that were at Olive, you'd bring up Olive Media and they'd say, oh, they throw the best summer parties.
That was the best part of my job, I have to say. I got to do marketing, so I was in charge of the parties, and we would start planning them I mean, at the beginning, we started planning them 6 months out. And by the end, we were sort of starting to plan the next party the day after the party had happened. We did our very first one was just a launch party. And then our second party, we decided to do a theme. And we threw it at Berkeley Church. And it was prom 2.0 was the theme that we had. And we encouraged people to come dressed in prom dresses. And I knew a balloon artist, and I convinced him to build us these giant martini balloon sculptures. And we hired a few models who were dressed entirely in balloon gowns. And we handed out balloon corsages at the door. And we had sort of created this crazy mystical place, and that kind of kickstarted it. After that, we did some great themes. We had a Western party where we had a mechanical bull. We threw a country club party that was in a great big space. It was at the government, and so the ceilings were incredibly tall. And I went in to look at the space the day before and thought, oh God, how are we going to fill this huge vertical space? And so I called a friend of mine who ran a circus school, and I said, Eli, can you get me a couple of stilt dancers who could play an imaginary game of tennis with like giant oversized tennis rackets over top of the dance floor to kind of fill some of this vertical space? So we had the permission to really have fun with these parties. By the end of it, we had probably 50% of our guests were showing up in costume, which was really fun. We had mermaids one year at a summer party. We had a disco party where we had a light up floor, and we had dancers that were teaching people how to do a disco line dance. They were goofy, glorious times, I'll say.
Your time at Checkout 51 as the VP of sales, would you say that was your first foray into retail media, and even before retail media was a term or a thing?
That's a very perceptive take on it. At the time, I moved to it because I knew it was once again the year of mobile. And I thought, I really need to figure out this mobile thing. This was an app. It had launched in Canada. They were preparing to launch it in the US. It was absolutely very focused on point of purchase and really on couponing, a completely innovative couponing approach. And yeah, it was very much about, you know, what we would call retail media today. It was very metrics driven. It was very measurement based. And it was very much with the part of the CPG company that was entirely focused on couponing and discounting. So that was a whole new relationship graph to create that I had not, they were, I was meeting all new people. I wasn't really able to pull on my, my connections and my relationships that I had spent, you know, some time building. So that was a really hard and really rewarding time in my life. That was a really exciting build.
How is the adjustment getting away from content? Because if we look at every other position you've had before, every one of those positions was rooted in content. But at Checkout 51, there was no content. It's like you said, the coupon and the deals, that's why people were jumping in.
Yeah, that's really perceptive. It was a completely different kind of sell. It was much more technical, and it was a completely different kind of company because it was a startup, and you really did need to negotiate for engineering time. And so we would literally do meetings, stand-up meetings, where we had points which represented the engineer's time. And I would say, I need a better ad server, or I need a better insight into this level of measurement. And I'd have to sort of duke it out with somebody who wanted user growth, for example, which was also important. And so we were constantly prioritizing how to build the business holistically, and not just what sales needed to be effective. And most importantly, it was very, very grounded in measurement, because we needed to be able to, a lot of these were test and learn budgets. We needed to be able to make a convincing argument to win the test budget, but then we really had to be able to deliver a convincing measurement story to demonstrate that the campaign had been effective. And so everything we did was very grounded in, you know, what does this look like right now? what will it look like after the measurement? And then can we build it, and to what extent? And it was tricky because it was one of those ideas that had a moment where about three companies had sort of come up with the same idea at the same time. And so while Checkout 51 was growing and building, there were other competitors that were also getting funding and were also coming after, you know, the same group of people with a competitive product. And so we had to be, you know, very aggressive, and we had to build and win. It was very high stakes. And it was a big territory because I was covering the US. I had a couple of team members that were working with me, but there were not very many of us. We were doing it from Toronto. We were traveling all the time, and we were covering a vast territory. So it was hard work. It was a lot of travel, and it was constant. It never stopped.
Was there an element of diplomacy to this role? Because going back, you mentioned that you kind of had to negotiate for time with the engineers, and there's this, I guess you could say, spirited debate between what you needed from a better ad server versus someone else wanting more focus on growth. Did you find that it was a bit of a chess game you were playing to get things done?
It wasn't so much internally. We were very good internally at being able to prioritize what needed to happen and when, and how to make those trade-offs. That was, yes, there was, you know, there always is internally a debate for resources. And I think that's true of any company. But that wasn't the hardest part. Really, the hardest part was being able to grow and drive revenue quickly enough to sustain the business. And particularly when our competitors were getting rounds and rounds of funding. But, you know, there really was a moment where I said to the founders, I don't know that we have enough boots on the ground to be able to do this. I think we need to partner with somebody, or we need to find somebody who has a team that can help, can partner with us and execute this. And ultimately, you know, we found a buyer. We were an interesting enough product that that News Corp was interested in acquiring the company and did so.
What brought you to Bell Media? And did you do all of these roles at once, or was you kind of building up to it? Because you were the VP, digital sales and platforms, and revenue management. Like, those are, again, a lot of hats to wear simultaneously.
Yeah. It did feel like every time I turned around, there was like a new job that was handed to me. So I started at Bell as just doing digital sales and platforms, and then RevMan got my remit got expanded to include RevMan about a year or two in. And the thing, the Bell opportunity made such good sense to me. I was excited to return to premium. Certainly the network model that we had developed and embraced at Olive Media had been largely eroded by programmatic. So premium display was less desirable. Premium video was still very important. And Bell had, you know, the most premium video anywhere. I had never sold video. It had been the year of mobile. Now it was the year of video. So I had an opportunity to go and had that function up. And in doing so, we did a lot of work around managing sort of yield management around the video inventory, understanding that it was in very limited supply, it was in very high demand. So really tweaking that that yield management piece. And I think that's why, because I did so much of that with the digital video inventory, when there was an opportunity to move revenue management under me, we were looking at the whole video pie at the same time.
Talk to me about the French-Canadian video pie, because my first job was at Astral Media prior to Bell acquiring the company, and our best-selling product, hands down, was French pre-roll, and Bell acquired Astral, so I believe you were probably part of the Bell team after Astral was acquired?
That's correct, yeah.
How much of a focus, or how much did it come up in meetings about French video, because that stuff you couldn't keep on the shelf?
It was impossible, And this is what I mean about yield management. Was there was a point at which it was you couldn't charge more than you know, this obscene amount. And so you had this very limited supply, huge demand, but there was also a tipping point after which you couldn't crank the rates anymore. People would just say, that's ridiculous. So there was a bit of a tightrope, and you got into how do we then bundle it? If you want access to this French video, what else are we going to ask you to buy? And is there a way to leverage this very valuable asset to also include other components maybe that are less desirable or come in at a lower CPM so you can blend the CPM and make it a little bit more palatable than this astronomical figure that by itself on a as a line item just, you know, didn't make sense.
What enticed you to jump into agency life at Wavemaker?
Yeah, that was my very first job agency side. I was offered an opportunity to come in at a CEO level. I thought to myself, my gosh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to really drive value here. I don't know that I know enough. And someone said, but no, that is the value that you bring is you're coming in with an outside perspective. You're coming in with a sales view. You've got a lot of digital experience. You really understand the inventory from the sales side. So you'll be bringing this new perspective that'll be very valuable. And so that convinced me to give it a try. I think when opportunity knocks, you either go to the door and welcome it in, or you fall asleep on the couch. I don't think so. You have to embrace it when the opportunity is there. And I have to say, I'm so glad I did. It was such a fascinating experience because I had been on the sales side my entire career. And for the first time, it was like I had been looking at a two-dimensional object and all of a sudden I was able to walk around the back of it. And I was like, oh, I see. There's this whole other dimension that I didn't really appreciate. And that really rounded out my appreciation for agencies and what they do and how they work and how difficult it is, quite frankly, for the people that work there. I have mad respect for the buyers and the planners and the strategists at agencies. They work very, very hard and they have a very tough job to do.
So it sounds like it made you more empathetic for the agency side of business. Did you find yourself reflecting on deals from years past and just kind of wondering, you know, why were the agencies so difficult about this, or why were they so hyper-focused on that? But now that you are on the other side of the business, you're like, I completely get why they raised those issues when we were negotiating.
That's exactly right. And I think for many sellers, you sort of wonder, why are the agencies, you know, so protective of this relationship with their client? Why don't they give me more access? Or, you know, why can't they explain this to their client? I'm not sure I understand why this is so hard. And it was after understanding what the dynamics were and how difficult they could be and how much pressure there was through procurement, how much pressure there was with the required review cycle. All of these things made it, you know, put an enormous amount of pressure on the agencies. And when they lost a piece of business, it was very difficult to rebound. And, you know, lots of times people lost their jobs as a result. And so it was very high stakes and very binary. You know, when you're in sales, you pitch much and hopefully hopefully win often, but you don't win everything. And that's kind of okay. When you're in agency land, it's very binary. Either you have the account or you don't. And if you have the account and you lose it, you know, that loss needs to be absorbed. And it just makes it puts an enormous amount of pressure and scrutiny on everything that you do. And so there's huge stakes all the time. And it's also just, you know, quite difficult to make money. It's the margins are very thin, and it can be really difficult. So yeah, I have a lot of empathy for how agencies operate, how hard they work, and how challenging some of those relationships can be.
Let's bring everything full circle back to Pinterest. I want to ask you how the opportunity presented itself.
I have loved Pinterest for many, many years. I've been an avid pinner since Pinterest really came to my attention. I've used it for many, many projects, and I really love it. And I have to say, I've always avoided more traditional forms of social media. I find that they don't make me feel good. It's easy to spend a lot of time on them, but it's not something that I find really fuels my joy. Whereas Pinterest has always been a place where I feel really comfortable, really soothed, really safe, really inspired. And so I had met the previous country manager of Pinterest, and I had learned that she had been promoted. And I started to wonder, you know, I wonder who they're going to get to do this job, and when are they going to fill it? And time passed and they didn't really fill it. And I finally reached out to her and said, you know, what are you doing with this role? What are you looking for? And she said, oh, you know, we've just reopened it. We're starting our search again. And it was at a moment, it was just after COVID. It was at a moment where I was wondering whether I really wanted to get back into sales. I really missed the sales cycle. And I said to her, really, maybe, you know, is that something that you would consider me for? And she said, well, why don't you join the process and, you know, see how it goes. And so I threw my hat in the ring and really worked as hard as I possibly could to get it. I decided, okay, this is a job that will really bring me enormous joy. And I think I can add a lot of value to this company. I love the platform. I feel really passionately about it. And I really think this would be a good fit for me. And so I basically insisted that they hire me, and worked as hard as I possibly could. I had to go through a number of rounds of interviews. And ultimately they did think it was a good fit, which pleased me so much.
You brought up something interesting. You mentioned that one of the things that appeals to you is that Pinterest, and I'm paraphrasing quite a bit, is one of those social media platforms that's better for your mental health. I was having a chat with someone about Pinterest a while back, and I said, I don't know who their CEO is. And they looked at me funny, and I said, it's not because I can't figure out or find out who this person is. It's just anytime you ever hear about some of the other leaders on other social media platforms, when you hear about them in the news, it's usually because they're in front of Congress trying to explain something that's gone horribly wrong with one of their users or a number of participants on their platform and trying to justify their existence and why they're not accountable for it. So that's one of the things I find very interesting about Pinterest, is that the leader, even though I'm sure this person is incredibly prolific, kind of flies under the radar there. And that's kind of like the best unspoken testimonial to just how much safer Pinterest is and can be compared to some of the other platforms.
Pinterest has made a very deliberate choice to prefer positive mental health outcomes to just driving mindless engagement. And this is apparent through all of the policy decisions that we've made through history. We were the first platform to ban misinformation around health, anti-vax content long before COVID. We were the first platform to ban climate misinformation. We don't accept political ads. We are very, very conscious about how we show up for our users. And truthfully, Pinterest is about driving people from inspiration to action. And so unlike platforms that where their algorithms are designed to put you on the platform and then hold you there for as long as possible so that they understand more about you, they're able to collect more data, they're able to serve more ads, Pinterest is really about inspiring you and then encouraging you to go and create in real life. What really we want you to do is to actually execute. And that means getting off the platform and doing and creating and being and living. And that in many ways that's sort of contrary to the, you know, the profit requirement of a regular of another platform where we're really just driving revenue at all costs and trying to create as many impressions as possible. And that's not what Pinterest is for. This isn't about engagement via enragement. We're not trying to make people angry. We're trying to inspire them and make them feel positive and make them feel good and allow them to do and allow them to create. You know, our mission is to inspire everyone to create a life they love. And if we're not doing that, then we're not living up to our mission.
I say this half jokingly, but does Pinterest have any data on how many weddings or bathroom or kitchen renovations they've influenced?
Oh my gosh, so many, so many. I love this. If you talk to anyone, they will say, oh yeah, I plan my wedding on Pinterest, or I plan my home reno on Pinterest. I met a woman recently who owns horses, and she was showing me her stable, which was absolutely spectacular. And I said, wow, how did you know how to build this? And she said, oh, I built it all on Pinterest. And I said, yeah, that absolutely makes sense. So there's so many use cases. But as I say, kind of big and small, you've got these huge, big life moments like weddings or you know, first baby. But then you've also got all of these little moments as well, which, you know, is like, what's for dinner tonight? Or, you know, what am I going to wear tomorrow? You know, all of these little moments, these sort of quotidian experiences, which Pinterest also inspires. And I love that it can stretch to like the huge, mighty, big, overarching, you know, expensive things, but then also these sort of micro moments that are also really meaningful.
What does a typical day look like for the Canadian country manager of Pinterest?
I try to spend a lot of time with my team, and I try to spend as much time as possible with clients. For me, you know, a lot of truth comes out of the field. And so I like to hear from clients about what's working, what they like, what are they thinking about, what are their priorities. And so I spend as much time as I can with clients, and I try to have those booked out a long time in advance so that I'm always getting a steady stream of information from all different kinds of categories. But at the same time, it's a very technical product. There are we're increasing our shoppability as much as possible. So our new CEO, his name is Bill Reddy, and he comes from a background in payments, and he is all about creating shoppability on Pinterest. One of the things he likes to say is, you know, when I first joined, Pinterest was like a mall, but all the stores were closed. You know, that's no good. Everybody could window shop, but nobody could actually buy. And so our focus as we move forward is about creating more shoppability. And that really means ensuring that the pipes are well connected with our clients, ensuring that we've got good catalog upload, ensuring we've got good measurement. One of the things that we are most focused on right now and have been for the past year or longer is around connecting our API for conversions with our clients so that when cookie deprecation really kicks in, we have good, strong measurement so that our clients are really able to understand what is driving success on their businesses and from what platforms it's coming.
Christy, this has been a fantastic chat. Are you ready for rapid fire questions?
Oh, always.
Okay, the campaign you are most proud of.
We did a campaign when I was at Wavemaker with Kruger. Susan Irving is a wonderful marketer. She was the CMO at the time, and she wanted to do something really earth-shattering. And we created a television campaign around the Cashmere collection, which of course had a component around breast cancer, featured all these incredible designers who were creating these astonishing dresses out of bathroom tissue. And the whole thing was made into a television series. And it was just amazing. I should say, I had very little to do with the actual execution. There were a lot of really talented and creative people who took the helm, but I was involved right at the very moment of inception. And so I'd like to claim it as my own, at least in part.
Your favorite movie?
I love movies. Film is something that I really love. I love old movies. I love Billy Wilder. So like Some Like It Hot or The Apartment are great. I love Quentin Tarantino. Pulp Fiction is one of my favorites. But if I had to just choose one, I have to say I love The Sting. It's got Paul Newman. It's got Robert Redford. Their chemistry is incredible. And it's a heist movie. It's a caper movie. It's got all kinds of little twists to it. I could watch it time and time again.
If Hollywood were to make a movie based on your life story, who would you want to play you?
I would love Kate Blanchett to take on that role. I think she is so elegant and so aspirational, but she also has this great comic quality that I really admire. I think she's got enormous range, and plus she's just absolutely gorgeous.
Your favorite book?
I love to read. I try to read 50 books a year. So I'm always bringing in lots, but I would say I'm a huge fan of Kate Atkinson. She wrote a book called Life After Life, which was a series of, it was really an exploration of World War II and all the different ways you could die. And I also love Ian McEwan. And one of my favorite books of his is Atonement.
Your favorite song?
Can I have an album? Can I choose a whole album?
Oh, by all means, please go for it.
I know albums aren't fashionable anymore. Everybody is only interested in one song, but my favorite album of the 90s was Mezzanine by Massive Attack. And that's still my go-to. If I need to do sort of deep thinking work, I'll pop in my headphones and have that play. There's something really really thought-provoking about the sound.
The best advice you have ever received.
Really early on in my career, my sort of my first year, my manager said to me, I was getting my first sales territory, and I said, I don't really know what I'm doing. And she said, it doesn't matter, just be a straight shooter. All you can do is tell people the truth, deliver on what you say that you're going to do, and follow up and follow through. And if you do that, you can always be proud of what you've done. And she's right. And I've lived with that advice my whole career.
My signature closing question: if you weren't in media, what would you be doing and why?
If I weren't in media, I would be running a dog rescue operation. I have two rescue mutts that I got about 6 and 7 years ago, and they have truly changed my life. They've changed how I interact with the world. I think everybody deserves to have that experience, and so yeah, I would look to try to find these beautiful animals, forever homes with people who could really benefit from the experience.
Christy, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you so much for dropping by.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.